This week on Pirate Party Radio, Facebook CEO accused of hacking other sites with Facebook user information. Last legal way of backing up your DVDs struck down as real DVD fails in court. And European Parliament overwhelmingly votes against the secrecy of ACTA. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 19 for Thursday, March 11th, 2010.
If Universal or EMI or any other big label made three false accusations of copyright infringement, right? So three strikes, that we could go over to their offices with a big set of bolt cutters, go to Knightsbridge, and chop off their internet access. And for a period of 1 year, they could be the record label that does all of their business by fax and carrier pigeon, right? It would be the corporate death penalty for them. That's what we're proposing to do to people who are accused but not convicted of file sharing and their families.
In my view, growing internet piracy is a vote of non-confidence in existing business models and existing legal solutions. And growing internet piracy should be a wake-up call for policymakers.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. The intro clips off the top of the show, the first one was Cory Doctorow talking about the three strikes rule applying to businesses to see how they'd like it on the other shoe or see how things could operate if the three strikes rule of ACTA went through. And also the second one was the EU commissioner talking about piracy should be a wake-up call for policymakers. That was Vivian Redding, a Luxembourg politician currently serving as a European commissioner for justice, fundamental rights, and citizenship. That one was sent in by DC. And we have some incoming messages this week. This first one is from Mom Monster. It says, "Hi, this is my first time here and reading about Pirate Party from all the world first people think it's nice to have a party around the world with the same idea. But don't you lacking without screen member, it's possible the true pirate men also become a member." And that's from Mom Monster. Interestingly worded letter. And I am guessing he's talking about screening out undesirables in the Pirate Party, but I guess it wouldn't be a bad thing as long as the people, the members, are supporting the Pirate Party and they support the same views and things that the Pirate Party stand for. I mean, if they don't, they're going to be if they're trying to get elected within the Pirate Party itself, it's not going to go very far if they don't hold the same kind of views and stances on things as the party in general. I think that's what he's talking about. It was a little hard to decipher. The next one is from Steve Parker from Great Southern Stand Radio Show. "Not sure if this one is quite what you're looking for. It's not a story so much as an example of the heightened paranoia generated by the current climate of non-commercial copyright infringement, which the Pirate Party is a large proponent for, of non-commercial copyright infringement," which it's copyright infringement right now, but if it was legalized, then it wouldn't be copyright infringement, would it? "At the moment, I'm doing a play with a fellow GSS panelist, James Whitrow. I have the main row, a role, and it's a huge one. As an aid to my performance, I usually film rehearsals for later study, and quite often film the last dress rehearsal for the rest of the class. For this play, James and I decided to go one step further and make a promo video for the play. At first, everyone was very excited, and then the president of the theater company found out about it. She proceeded to go over the script of the promo video and demand we remove two lines from the play we had used. I would have thought that even the copyright holders would still enjoy free publicity, but there you are. And I also stopped filming rehearsals. Stop filming rehearsals? In a logical universe, this makes no sense. No one, and I mean no one, would have any interest in all those videos other than me. Picture, if you will, actors prancing about a bare stage in their normal clothes, filmed in an enormous echo chamber with cheap digital video camera. Not exactly Hollywood quality stuff. The worst thing, though, is that I can't blame her for being so paranoid. After some of the recent stories, she has every right to worry that her theater company's very existence may well be at stake, should some shark lawyer decide that my rehearsal videos breached copyright. It's my view that we need this sort of cash-hungry, art-killing, parasitic nitpicking to be dealt with so that creative people can bring back what they do best, creating things. Therefore, more power to the Pirate Party. Steve Parker, Great Southern Stand. Very interesting thing going on there. I believe that you are true in the fact that she was probably just being overly paranoid so that the lawyers don't go after her theater company and sue it for all it's worth, because that's what happens. You see these stories in the news all the time about somebody misappropriately using copyrighted material. I'm sure the play company that you're doing this play for has purchased and paid for the rights to the play that was written, because copyright's in perpetuity for 70 plus, life plus 70 of the artist or company, 90 years, depending on where you are in the world. So I can understand her paranoia not wanting to be sued through the floor. She's not ready to sacrifice her theater company in a stance against the enormous copyright length of time that's happening. Next letter. I just listened to the intro for the 3-4 show, episode 18, and I realized something. This is not about copyright law. This is about freedom. As an American, I would say that this is about First Amendment freedoms, specifically abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble. What has happened is that YouTube and sites like it have become the public forum where people assemble and speak their minds. However, YouTube-like sites are not actual physical public squares. They're privately owned websites that can be attacked. Opponents are using unreasonable and unpracticable regulation to silence local websites or ban international ones. Since humans have had the capacity to communicate, they have told stories. These stories came to be the medium through which a culture's beliefs and values were communicated. This began to change with the advent of broadcast media. Instead of the elders telling the young stories about Paul Bunyan and Davy Crockett, they began listening to the Lone Ranger on the radio or watching Batman on television. Now the people generating media have control of our stories. When they took control of our stories, they took control of our values. Some of it was a good message, but they soon discovered that people's purchasing behavior was strongly directed by the media consumed. As an example, after a Clark Gable movie came out where he took off his shirt and men saw that he had no undershirt on beneath it, t-shirt sales dropped significantly. Now this power to control our stories is under attack by us. People are watching less TV and consuming more media made by the people who make no money from it. Our culture is beginning to be redirected by the people, by normal folks, as it was before broadcast media. This is a direct threat to the existing power structure, and those are in it are doing everything in their power to reestablish control. These truly bizarre laws coming out of Europe, Australia, and the like are irrefutable evidence of it. This has to stop. We're rapidly approaching a disturbing amalgamation of government and large corporations working to establish control, as well as a loss anonymity and therefore freedom on the net. As usual, you're doing important work. Keep it going. That's from Tong Chop. Very good insight into YouTube. And now that's the public speaking corner or stories passed on from person to person, and it's widespread throughout the world, and they're losing control. The people that were in control once have now lost it, in control for the past 100 years through radio, print, or even longer than 100 years, but 100 years through radio and television, very powerful means, and even beyond that through the printed word, as far back as the printed word was invented, instead of, you know, monks transcribing it by hand into books. So incredible insight there by Tong Chop. Thank you very much for that letter. And if you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. Now, in pirate news, we have privacy news from the U.S. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg needs to address the hacking incidents. On Friday, we reported the results of a long investigation into the origins of Facebook and revealed startling new information about the company's early days. Among other things, the investigation revealed that Facebook's founder and CEO, Mark Zuckerberg took private Facebook member login information and used it to break into the private email accounts of those members. At best, this is a gross misuse of private information. Facebook has not denied that this incident took place. Facebook has also not denied that Mark later hacked into the servers of a competitor, ConnectU, and changed some user information. Given the general unease about the use of privacy and personal information online, and particularly at Facebook, and given lingering concerns about Mark's business ethics, Mark needs to address these incidents directly and forthrightly. At the time of the abuses, Mark was a 19-year-old college sophomore. If not an excuse, this is certainly a potentially mitigating factor, assuming that, in the 6 years since, Mark has significantly changed his attitude towards privacy and strengthened his sense of business ethics. A person close to Facebook argues that Mark has changed, and in that, in fact, it was a fallout from these and early mistakes that have helped shape the rigorous privacy policies Facebook has today. We hope so, and based on the charges at Facebook over the past few years, as well as our interactions with Mark, we can believe it. But it's a critical issue for Facebook. Facebook's 400 million users and Mark, especially because 25 is not generally an age which people can just dismiss youthful indiscretions with a wave of the hand. So we need to hear directly from Mark. Specifically, we need to hear Mark explain why, despite these early incidences, Facebook's members can be certain with their private information is safe with the company, and as well as how and why his own attitudes towards privacy and business ethics have changed in the past 6 years. So the root of this story is basically about your privacy and how much privacy you're giving up to these social networking sites that are just asking for it. They're outright, say, fill in these boxes and give us all your private information. And a lot of sites ask for, you know, password recovery questions, such as your mother's maiden name or your birthday or the city you were born in or your first car or your pet's name, or things like that. Now, the same information is entered into multiple websites for the same password recovery. Like, you entered into MySpace, you entered into Facebook, you entered into your email account so you can get your passwords back, or get information back and get access once you've forgotten your password, say you haven't used it in a while. This has to change on the part of company privacy policies and also on the part of people using these sites. People have to be aware that not only is it on one site, it's on all these sites that you're entering into. So a privacy breach, whether the data has been maliciously escaped, or if somebody's hacked into it, or if it's left in a car on a thumb drive, or a hard drive is recycled at a flea market and somebody ends up with it, people have to be aware that their private information is going to be distributed, or possibly distributed. And what I've found is that there's a decent open source solution for keeping your passwords, because this also goes on to passwords. People use passwords for their same password for every site, because it's very difficult to remember passwords for every single site. So people end up using the same exact, possibly not very strong password for a lot of their sites. And what I found is I did a quick search. I didn't do a thorough search. And I found an open source program that can keep your passwords in one handy location. All you have to do is remember one password. It's keepass.info, KEEPASS.info. I haven't done a lot of research on this, so don't take my word for it. Do your own research. Check out if there's any criticisms of this program. But it is open source, which lends its credibility. People can examine exactly what's going on. It's for all the operating systems. So if anybody else out there has another good software solution or methods of keeping track of unique passwords for each website, just send me an email with some info on that, because I'm very interested in that. I'm sure the listeners need that kind of information to protect their privacy as well. I've seen a lot of websites showing the strength of your password. You can type in your password and it says how strong it is, whether you use repeating characters, upper, lowercase, numbers, order they're in. So if anybody has that kind of information, send it in and I can pass it on to the listeners. And the next news story, free culture news from the UK. Internet access is a fundamental right. This is sent in by Scott. Almost 4 in 5 people around the world believe that access to the internet is a fundamental right, a poll for the BBC World Service suggests. The survey of more than 27,000 adults across 26 countries found strong support for net access on both sides of the digital divide. Countries such as Finland and Estonia already have ruled that access is a human right for its citizens. International bodies such as the UN are also pushing for universal net access. The right to communicate cannot be ignored, Dr. Hamadoun Tour, Secretary General of the International Telecommunications Union, told BBC News. The internet is the most powerful potential source of enlightenment ever created. He said that governments must regard the internet as basic infrastructure, like roads, waste, and water. We have entered the knowledge society, and everyone must have access to participate. The study conducted by GlobeScan for BBC also revealed divisions on the question of government oversight of some aspects of the net. Web users questioned in South Korea and Nigeria felt strongly that the government should never be involved in the regulation of the internet. However, a majority of those in China and many European countries disagreed. In the UK, for example, 55% believed that there was a case for some government regulation of the internet. The finding comes as the UK government tries to push through its controversial digital economy bill, as well as promising to deliver universal broadband in the UK by 2012. The bill could also see a so-called three strikes rule become law. This rule would give regulators new power to disconnect or slow down the net connections of persistent illegal file sharers. Other countries, such as France, are also considering similar laws. Recently, the EU adopted internet freedom provisions, stating that any measures taken by member states that may affect citizens' access to or use of the internet must respect the fundamental rights and freedoms of its citizens. So this is a very important story showing that people's regard of the internet are showing that it's as important as their access to, say, education or water or any of the essentials that we regard as commonplace today. And the internet is being more ingrained in our society. Imagine if you couldn't access the internet. What if you weren't allowed to access the internet? Your access to information would be substantially hindered. Being able to access governmental websites, information that could help you in life, doctor information, you'd be completely hampered by this. And I think it's moving more and more towards a society where people regard this as something that they find essential. As people have grown up with computers and the internet, they've gotten used to being able to access this. And as the population ages, it's going to become more and more like this until everybody regards this as an essential service, and governments are forced to be able to are going to be forced to regard this as a basic human right to be able to have the internet. And hopefully these laws, like the three strikes law, cannot come into place where people will be forced off the internet by the corporations to be able to lock down on an outmoded way of making money. Next story, in copyright and free culture news from the UK. archiving Britain's Web, the legal nightmare explored, sent in by DC, a proposal that could give select institutions the power to take snapshots of websites without their owner's permission is being ruminated by our government. Civil servants at the Department of Culture, Media, and Sport are now processing opinions on whether we should be archiving websites for future generations. While it is likely that any changes to the 2003 Legal Deposit Libraries Act won't be tackled by the present government, the public consultation has raised some interesting questions. Should we be treating websites as culturally important artifacts? Should we be taking regular snapshots of websites and saving them in searchable and accessible archive? Whose responsibility is this? And most importantly, should copyright on websites be ignored so that their content can be saved? The British Library, the National Library of Wales, and a Wellcome Library are among the institutions that lobbied the government on the 2003 Legal Deposit Libraries Act. It is this act that stipulates that a copy of every printed publication made in this country is sent to the British Library, and on request, to five other deposit libraries, which include the National Library of Scotland, the National Library of Wales, and the Bodleian Library, Oxford. The institutions argued that the act needs to be adapted to include websites, allowing them to archive websites without contacting the owner. The British Library has in fact been accessing websites for 6 years. Last week, it unveiled the culmination of this work, an archive of 6,000 websites it deems culturally significant, called the UK Web Archive. These include the websites from high street shops that fell prey to the recession and the website for Anthony Gormley's fourth plinth art installation in Trafalgar Square. The archive has been available to the public since the end of last year. However, as Stephen Bury, head of European and American collectives, told Wire, the new website is more useful as you can search by subject. Now, this is very, very important because this could cause a digital dark age if we do not archive the internet as it is. As things get more and more digitized, we won't have all this information in a hard format. And as companies go out of business, like web hosting companies like, who knows, like Angelfire or some of those old school websites that contain information that is now not held anywhere, say about old things that were happening 10 years ago, 15 years ago, where are you going to get that kind of information if nobody knows about it anymore and it's wiped off the internet? Good sites like archive.org are archiving the internet, and I think it's a good way to, because anybody can access these websites. If you request a URL and the information from a website, it will serve it to you. It has no problem serving it to you. And I think as long as these websites that are archiving this information are not making money directly from this information, and kind of reselling it, then it is a non-commercial use of the data, which I'm a proponent for. And archiving this is very vital so we don't end up losing all this decades of information just because the websites go offline. I enjoy going to archive.org and looking back at my website and how it's progressed through the years and all the information that has been on it but is not on it anymore because I've taken it down or updated the website, the look of the website. And I think it's very important that we keep a record of what's happened. And think of if we had all the records from all the libraries that have been burned down over the thousands of years, all the records that have been lost, and if we kept it for, if we were able to keep it and have access to this, imagine how the history books would be. It would be amazing to read all this information, but now it's lost. And having backups and following the model that the Legal Deposit Library Act of 2003 mandates that you keep multiple copies in multiple locations. This is the exact thing we need. Have multiple copies stored of archiving websites in multiple locations and have an opt-out. If companies don't want their website archived, they can go and opt out. And it's no skin off their back. Yes, they do have to do a bit of work, but you have to put it on a balance and put it on a scale and show who is the beneficiary of this information. The beneficiary is the general public so that we can look at these archives and see what happened through these decades that we're living in right now, rather than losing it little by little each year and things being replaced and things being updated and the companies and corporations twist this information any way they want. If they want to erase something from history, well, they still would be able to if they could opt out, I suppose. But if somebody else archives it and reports about companies, it can't just disappear as those go offline. So this is a very important topic. In World Free Speech News, World Day Against Cyber Censorship. Reporters Without Borders will celebrate World Day Against Cyber Censorship on the 12th of March, which is tomorrow. This event is intended to rally everyone in support of a single internet that is unrestricted and accessible to all. It is also meant to draw attention to the fact that by creating new spaces for exchanging ideas and information, the internet is a force for freedom. However, more and more governments have realized this and are reacting by trying to control the internet. Reporters Without Borders will mark the occasion by issuing its latest list of the enemies of the internet. This list will point the fingers at countries such as Iran, China, Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, and Tunisia that restrict online access and harass their netizens. A list of countries that have been placed under surveillance for displaying a disturbing attitude towards the internet will also be released. Reporters Without Borders will award the first Netizen Prize with support from Google at 7 p.m. 11th of March 2010 on the eve of World Day Against Cyber Censorship. The prize will be given to an internet user, blogger, or cyber dissident who has made a notable contribution to the defense of online freedom of expression. The award ceremony will take place at the Paris headquarters of Google France. Reporters Without Borders have designated a logo to symbolize the defense of online free expression. It represents a computer mouse freeing itself from chains. The logo can be downloaded for free of charge and available in various colors, blah, blah, blah. Hopefully WikiLeaks is in the running for this, because they have done so much to keep the internet free and been able to defend itself against these countries that wish to take and censor information that should be distributed to the public. So this is very interesting, and I'll be checking it out tomorrow to see who they elect and see who the runners-up were. Hopefully they also list people that were also in contention. It doesn't say how you vote on them or who votes on them. I guess this organization just elects one, but maybe it'll be open to the public next year as it gains more interest in it. Copyright news from the U.S. You cannot copyright a tweet. Contrary to popular belief and Twitter's terms of service, you cannot copyright a tweet. Under U.S. law, copyright is granted on publication to original works of authorship, finalized in fixed forms of expression, but this does not extend to names, titles, or short phrases. As messages sent via Twitter can be no longer than 140 characters, they cannot be copyrighted. However original, witty, or profound that they may be, nothing more than the good manners protects your original expression of authorship. If you wish to let other people quote or use your tweets, you need not license them. Indeed, technically, you cannot license them, since they are in the public domain the instant you publish them. If you write a clever tweet and wish to assert ownership, if money is no object, you may apply for a trademark. And they say good luck with that. Otherwise, your tweets are like the air. Anyone can do anything like them, anything they like to them, including quoting them with or without your permission. If an enterprising company wishes to take something you said on Twitter and slap it on a t-shirt, they may do so. If a gent of the disturbed persuasion wants to engrave your tweet into a 600-foot swastika, he may do so. Non-Germany. If this disturbs you, suck it up or stop using Twitter, or mark your Twitter feed as private. This will not copyright your Twitter mutterings, but it will keep many people from seeing them. If this deeply disturbs you and money is no object, mount a case to change the law. Me, I plan to use Twitter forever, and any party so inclined to make a whistle of my tweets, but me saying so is irrelevant because you cannot copyright a tweet. Digging through the comments page, came up with some interesting things I found. This is me saying this, because I looked through the comments, because that is the most interesting things of posts, because the contribution from the rest of the internet commenting and being able to dig down deeper. Now, I found a website that are you able to put a Creative Commons stamp kind of on your Twitter feed. And it says publish and license tweets with Creative Commons. Now, this may not apply to the US, may apply to other countries, and it may just be for future proofing your tweets. So people do know how you do want them licensed, whether it prevents them or not prevents them. Is that tweetcc.com. TweetCC started as a conversation on Twitter between Andy Clark and Brian Suda. Andy wanted to show tweets and avatars for a new book on web design. His publisher needed to get permission and republish. That meant asking everyone. This is not too fine a point to put too fine a point on it. A pain, Brian agreed. It would be nice if Twitter could allow for a Creative Commons or other license on your comment. Then people don't have to ask. Twitter is clear that they make no intellectual claims over your tweets, as they should. We claim no intellectual property over the material you provide. Your profile materials uploaded remain yours, Twitter says. Twitter also encourages users to contribute their creations to the public domain or consider progressive licensing terms. But what about people who want to reproduce your tweets? With no tweet license policy, republishing them without an asking is a bit of a gray area. TweetCC makes it easier for you to offer your tweets under Creative Commons public domain dedication or other Creative Commons licenses. Anyone wanting to reproduce tweets can do then without asking you. We don't ask for your Twitter login. Our password is this password is anti-pattern practice teaches people how to be fish. Don't scatter your passwords around like chicken feed, which I talked about earlier. TweetCC is not affiliated with Twitter, although we hope one day Twitter will make TweetCC part of its user sign-up process. We're not affiliated with Creative Commons, but we do love what they do. So what it does, it basically puts one of your tweets as kind of a comment, directing them to the website and outlining how you would like your Twitter comments to be viewed. You could also just bypass that whole website and just skip directly to the Creative Commons site and say, I am licensed under Creative Commons. And that might be a better way to do it. But it is an interesting idea so that you can cut out the middleman of TweetCC. Obviously, they're trying to get some it looks like they're trying to get some money from Twitter to buy them so that they can incorporate their idea. And and something else I saw in the comments as well is a Wikipedia article on Ashley Brilliant, which is something that somebody brought up. Ashley Elwood Brilliant is an author and syndicated cartoonist living in Santa Barbara. He is best known for his potshot single-panel illustrations with one-line humorous remarks. And people brought him up because Twitter is kind of a one-line remark. The Wall Street Journal described him in a 1992 profile as history's only full-time professional published epigrammist. In a copyright infringement suit filed by Brilliant, a United States federal judge ruled that while short phrases are not eligible for copyright, Brilliant's works were epigrams and therefore copyrightable. In an essay entitled Against Intellectual Property, Brian Martin cites Ashley Brilliant as a professional epigrammist who's been known to threaten legal action in order to display his market precedence over legally owned fragments of human language, thus managing to reveal one of the many absurdities behind intellectual property, namely its ability to limit free use and dissemination of human expression. When Brilliant finds somebody who has used one of his epigrams, he contacts them demanding a payment for breach of copyright. For instance, television journalist David Brinkley wrote a book, Everyone is Entitled to My Opinion, the title of which he attributed to a friend of his daughter. Brilliant contacted Brinkley about copyright violation and Random House, Brinkley's publisher, and paid Brilliant $1,000 without contesting the issue. In a separate 1979 case, a company copied two of Brilliant's phrases. I may not be totally perfect, but parts of me are excellent. And I've abandoned my search for truth and now looking for a good fantasy. And altered a third phrase, all for sale on t-shirt transfers. The district court acknowledged that the phrases were distinguished by conciseness, cleverness, and pointed observation, ruling that they were protected by copyright. So, digging into that, if your tweets are concise, clever, pointed observation, they are protected by copyright. So remember out there, keep them clever and you're protected. Very interesting insight. So while they say they're not protected, they in fact are if they're clever enough. Very funny. I would wonder the court case ruling on if your tweet is clever enough or not. Is this tweet clever? I don't know. It's kind of funny, but it's kind of not. We'll have to see how that plays out if anybody tries to contest the first copyright on a tweet. Copyright news from the U.S. DMCA muscle kills DVD copying for real. There's something clever. Those awaiting a legitimate method to duplicate DVDs for personal use will likely have to wait even longer, perhaps forever, after Real Networks tossed in the white towel and abandoned litigation on the matter. Real Networks spent almost 2 years in legal battle with the MPAA, which sued the Seattle company to block the sale of its DVD copying software and hardware, generally known as Real DVD. The company said late Wednesday it's dropping its appeal of an August federal court decision that declared Real DVD an illegal violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998. Wow, it's been that long. The act, which Hollywood studios strongly lobbied for, prohibits the circumvention of encryption technology. DVDs are encrypted with what is known as the CSS, Content Scramble System, and DVD players must secure a license to play discs. Real DVD, U.S. District Judge Marilyn Hall Patel ruled, circumvents the CSS technology and designed to prevent copying, and is therefore a breach of the CSS license. The litigation cost Real Networks millions of dollars, including a $4.5 million to reimburse the MPAA for its legal costs. The outcome cost Rob Glasser, Real Networks CEO, his job. Most important, Real Networks admitted defeat solidifies DMCA power and leaves it in a wake of legal and political vacuum. There is no active momentum to legalize the duplication of DVDs under the DMCA, and every attempt to do so has failed. For the moment, consumers will have to opt for underground services like Handbrake, which is very good, and others to copy their DVDs, a practice whose legality is questionable under Patel's ruling. Pirates and sharing movies on illicit BitTorrent sites are also available, clearly unlawful under Copyright Act. In the end, there is no legitimate method to copy one's DVDs, even children's DVDs that are often scratched by the juvenile owners. Copying DVDs amounts to theft, the MPAA General Counsel Daniel Mandel said Wednesday, and Real Network's white flag has emboldened the movie studio's litigation arm, which Mandel said would vigorously pursue companies that attempt to bring these illegal circumvention products and devices to market. By suing Real Networks in 2008, the Hollywood studios showed they feared losing control of the DVD and music industry did with the CD. It's okay to copy music from CDs, for example, and place it in an iPod, yet it's illegal to do the same with a DVD. When it comes to the DVD, there's not even a question of fair use allowed under copyright law. As it turns out, the DMCA protects the DVD, but not the CD. And I'm guessing that's because the CD is not encrypted by some mechanism. Hollywood lobbied hard for the DMCA in part to produce the DVD. The studios were savvy enough to see how easy it was to duplicate the CD, which was not encrypted. Attempts to lace the CDs with digital rights management had failed, and miserably, if you remember, because it was putting Trojans on people's computers at the same time. But the DVD was different from the CD. It was born with encryption, now called the CSS. It's designed to prevent duplication under the DMCA. Gadgets and software allowing duplication of encryption protection works are prohibited. And it goes on and on about the history of CSS and DMCA. But that is very, very sad to hear that Real Networks has been fighting all this time for us to be able to back up our DVDs in case they get scratched. And I'm sure parents out there know that DVDs get scratched. Kids slide them in along the tray, scratching the DVDs, and eventually they get unplayable, so that you'd have to go out and buy another DVD, which of course the studios would love. But you can't back up your own DVD because of this loophole. You can on CD, but not DVD. It's obvious it is a loophole and not a legal thing. It's a loophole created by the corporations so that you can't do it. Otherwise, it would be enforced on the CD because they're both copyrighted material. Very interesting. But it's all gone, and DVDs are almost on their way out anyway, or they're declining because of Blu-ray and digital content delivery systems over the internet and other things to set-top boxes, etc. So it would have set a great precedence for other things that do circumvent the DMCA for fair use, kind of fair uses, for use in the home, for backing up things, or for transferring it to another device, like they mentioned, the iPod or a computer or some device that you take on with you to on an airplane or on vacation. Very sad, Dandy. Copyright news from the U.S. OK Go ditches label over YouTube embedding rights, ascended by DC. How many times does a band have to take the music video world by storm before its record label gets that its members might know a little something about music videos? We may never find out, because OK Go, the band in question, has just ditched EMI, the record label in question, largely due to that very problem. OK Go rocketed up through the indie world, rock world, in large measure due to the band's brilliant lo-fi music videos, which has spread like wildfire on YouTube, which they are very good music videos. But EMI, in a misguided attempt to wring every penny out of the band's success, decided to block embedding on the YouTube videos, meaning that videos were unable to disseminate out through music and pop culture blogs, news sites, and personal blogs the way they did before the restriction. And that's not a minor detail. The band saw a 90% drop in views when that restriction went into effect, as in 100,000 views in one day and 10,000 the next. OK Go isn't a band with huge radio singles. They're a journeyman power pop act that puts out reliably excellent, not blockbuster albums. Music videos are the band's way of making themselves buzzworthy, and it works. Their homemade videos have achieved a level of popularity nobody could have predicted. So when the label made their videos less popular, it means, in no uncertain terms, that less people out there know about OK Go, which means less people can buy albums and tickets for the hard touring band's shows. It's a ridiculous decision from the label, and the band was never shy about voicing their discontent, even in the most public way possible. Now, this is boneheaded, in my opinion. Music videos are there for promotion. Promotion only. That's why they make them. Unfortunately, on the TV, you can't watch music videos anymore because there are no music video channels. It's a way gone the way of the dodo. The only place you can watch music videos is on the internet. And there's hundreds of great blogs that pull out the best of music videos from YouTube and other websites, so you can see them and enjoy these bands. I found OK Video, the latest one, which is a brilliant video, a one-shot video of them going around the room. Oh, I can't remember the name. Rube Goldberg's Inventions. It's a style of stringing things together, like balls going down ramps, hitting other things that knock over something else. It pulls a string, opens a window shade, etc., etc. That I think that Rube Goldstein's invention. I think that's what it's called. But it's brilliant. Go check it out. But they're blocking OK Go's videos from being posted on blogs so people can find out about these great videos. It's a way of promotion. They're thinking backwards. EMI is shutting down their distribution method. It is not making a lot of sense. And as you can see, a semi-popular band, a somewhat known band, has now left because of that. And I can see a lot more bands leaving the major labels because they just don't agree with how they're being promoted. It's backwards. It's the old way of keeping such a tight rein on your bands that nobody can even find out about them. And I can see the bands, the labels shriveling up and dying because of this. And I saw posted today somewhere people saying that people don't buy music based on who's releasing it. I mean, the companies that are releasing it. Nobody's going to buy music because they like the bands on EMI necessarily. They buy music because they like the band, not who bought the band or who owns the band. It's the music that sells the records, and it's the music videos that promotes the records and the band itself. So they're shooting themselves in the foot. Very bad way about going it. And thankfully, OK Go has made a name for itself by doing this and highlighting this problem. So it works in their benefit, as I can see it right now, and it doesn't work in the benefit of EMI. Now on to Pirate Party news. Dutch Pirate Party joins election race. Following the footsteps of the Swedes and Germans, the Dutch Pirate Party has decided to join the national elections being held this spring. The Pirate Party booked a surprising victory by scooping 2 seats in the European Parliament last year, but is yet to score its first elected seat in a national parliament. Pirate Party 2 was a breakthrough year for the Pirate Party movement. With more than 7% of the vote, the Swedish Pirate Party secured 2 seats in the European Parliament. A few weeks later, the pirates in Germany entered the local parliament after a member of another party switched sides. In 2010, the Pirate Party hopes to continue this hot streak, especially during the Swedish national elections later this year. However, Sweden is not the only country where a Pirate Party will end up at the ballot. In the UK, the local Pirate Party hopes to compete as well, and the Dutch Pirate Party now has decided to do the same. In recent months, there's been a lot of political debate regarding Dutch copyright law, which currently allows people to download copyrighted movies and music for personal use. Several established parties have shown interest in criminalizing file sharers, something the Pirate Party hopes to avoid. Instead, the pirates would like to shorten the copyright term to 5 years and legalize sharing of all copyrighted material in the internet. Tim Kuk, head honcho at the local anti-piracy outfit Brin, is not afraid of politically organized pirates and described the party's plans as short-sighted and unrealistic. Samir Aluai, chairman of the Pirate Party, told Torrent Freak he's very happy with Kuik's negative comments. "He gives people a good reason to vote for us," he said, referring to the negative views that most people have of Brian. If elected, the party will do everything it can do to stop abuses of copyright, promote net neutrality, and push for patent reform. The party is further committed to increasing transparency, strengthening fundamental rights, and protecting privacy. Despite the enthusiasm of the party's members, there is still a long way to go before they can actually compete in the election on June 9th. One of the biggest hurdles is the requirement deposit of a sum of €12,000, a barrier which means to prevent too many parties from entering the election. Samir is confident they will be able to raise the money in the weeks to come. He encourages all sympathizers to become a member of the party and help get the Pirate Party on the ballot. So anybody who's in the Netherlands listening to this, go out and seek the Dutch Pirate Party's website and check out what they're doing. ACTA supporters, UKIP named and shamed. This is from Pirate Party UK. Opposition to the secret ACTA treaty is spreading like wildfire. Today, the members of the European Parliament have their say, as on a resolution against the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, arguing that it flouts agreed EU laws on counterfeiting and piracy online. MEPs will go to the Court of Justice if the EU does not reject the leaked proposals, which include draconian powers to censor the internet and disconnect net connections. The result was a massive landslide in favor of open government and internet freedom. 636 MEPs were on the side of freedom, and just 10 voted in favor of ACTA. And it goes on to list the people who did vote in favor of ACTA. And personally, it says from the UK Pirate Party side, it says, I'm quite simply disgusted. If those names make you feel ashamed to be British, you can do something about it right now. Join the Pirate Party UK. Make a donation. Come forwards as a candidate for us. Make sure your voice is heard." And this is their press release. "Today marks a change in the tide for anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, as MEPs once again aligned with the pirate ideals to vote in favor of fully transparent negotiations. In a landslide 636-10 decision, the European Parliament threatened the Commission with legal action if the MEPs continue to be kept in the dark. EU negotiators will now be forced to go cap in hand to the ACTA negotiation table to obtain other delegations' agreement on full transparency. The United States have a well-documented stance against transparency in the treaty's negotiations, and as a result, may very well end up stalling ACTA indefinitely." Pirate Party UK leader Andrew Robinson said, "This is a great day for the principles of freedom and democracy, but I'm quite simply disgusted that the majority of the opposition to open, accountable government comes from our own country. This is not the first time the MEPs have called for openness in these proceedings, having voted not once but twice against the secretive nature of the talks. But the resolutions have up until now been ignored by the EU's negotiating team. Now, however, it seems that the Commission will have to listen. It's not only national pirate parties that have been critical of Act of Secrecy. Criticism have been rife and has been flooded from all walks of life, including academia, the telecommunications industry, civil rights groups, and web megacorporations such as Google. Only 13 MEPs voted in favor of ACTA, 10 of them members of UKIP, elected to represent this country, but choosing instead to support a worldwide treaty that they have never even read, negotiating in secret beyond the reach of democracy. And it goes on saying, let's see, a UKIP, that these are the people that voted against it, against this. UKIP representative have asked for a right to reply, and I'm happy to add this statement from them. Whilst we as a group voted against the ACTA resolution on Wednesday, 10th of March 2010, we did so on the principle that ACTA treaty itself should not exist in any form. It's a catastrophic violation of individual private property. Had we voted to support the resolution, we would be recognizing the existence of such legislation, and on that basis, we decided to not recognize the treaty. So that really kind of boosts, with that statement, boosts it up to, almost across the board favor of opening up and dismissing the secrecy behind ACTA so the general population can find out what is going on. Now, Hindgrinder alerted me to this. It's very short notice. You have to act on this very quickly. It's something called Your Interview with Prime Minister Stephen Harper. And this is the Canadian Prime Minister. But this is open for voting for everyone around the world, I think. I've tested it, and people in other countries can vote for this. So please make your vote count for this. It says, submit your questions for Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper in his response to the speech from the throne and the recent budget. The Prime Minister will answer a selection of your top voted questions in an exclusive YouTube interview next Tuesday, March 16th, 2010 at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Submissions and voting will end on Sunday, March 14th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So don't forget to submit your questions for the Prime Minister. Now, I submitted a video question for the Prime Minister about ACTA and the secrecy behind ACTA and what the government is doing to oppose the secrecy. Now, to find my question, go to youtube.com/talkcanada and then search for ACTA, A-C-T-A, and then just look for my name, James O'Brien. It appears you do have to sign into YouTube to vote, but you could just give it a try anyway. And if you do have a sign-in, sign into to YouTube and just click on the up arrow or the thumbs up arrow, thumbs up. And I have verified that people outside of Canada are able to vote, so don't hold back. And take a look at the other topics of interest that would also be important as well, and make sure that you upvote them too. But the importance of ACTA should be addressed to the Prime Minister of Canada so we know what the stance of the Prime Minister is on ACTA and whether or not this can be opened up and get the secrecy away from these negotiations so the public can find out what is being negotiated behind closed doors, behind the with the 11 governmental bodies and the MPAA, RIA, Microsoft, the BSA, and scores of other corporations. Why are the corporations able to negotiate our rights away, but citizens are not even able to read what's being negotiated? What gives the corporations the right above citizens to negotiate these acts on behalf of us? Or are governments be able to negotiate these acts on behalf of us when we don't have a say because we can't find out what's in the ACTA agreement beyond what's been leaked onto the internet? That's not how we should be able to vote with our voices. Be able to find out what our government's doing behind secret doors when it's leaked onto the internet. So please go and vote for this. youtube.com/talkcanada and search for ACTA, A-C-T-A, and just upvote, look for my name, James O'Brien. There's only two right now, but there may be other people, including Jake Danes, the Pirate Party leader of Canada, who'll be posting his video as well. So upvote both of them. Upvote anything about ACTA so we can get it out in the open. So I've got some closing words and closing tracks. I want to recommend a great write-up about the perception of originality in creative works titled The Cult of Originality. This was sent in by DC. It states that all artwork is derivative and not created in a vacuum, which ties it in with the free culture and the importance of public domain. There's also a nice video that goes along with it and complements this idea, and I posted that in the forum. So take a look at that. It's great stuff and a good read. Lots of pictures to illustrate how things are derivative from older things, how works build upon other works. And if it's locked down by copyright for hundreds of years, everything will soon be owned by the corporations through patents, copyright, and other means, so that while the public is not being able to access our culture, it's being locked away, and we'll be sued for even trying to be creative. So take a look at that. Also, there's a great cartoon by Brad Colbo entitled Why DRM Doesn't Work, or How to Download an Audiobook from the Cleveland Public Library. And it gives a good example of trying to digitally borrow an audiobook from the library versus downloading it from a torrent site. If successful, both end up with similar results. Nobody has moved a book, and you end up with an audiobook, and nobody is, you know, deprived of anything. But it shows the hoops you have to jump through to be compliant with the DRM, and it showed in full. It's great. So take a look at that. Also, at the end of the show, I'm going to air something that I recorded, a piece written by Richard Stallman called The Right to Read. A lot of you out there have probably read it. It's a great piece of fiction, which echoes a lot of what's currently going on lately. So I thought it was appropriate to create a spoken word version of it. I'd read it online before, but it was recently sent in by Mobile Diesel, which prompted me to record it because it's great for this show. The music behind it is a Creative Commons piece called Shunned by Derek R. Audette, and you can find both of the links on the Pirate Party Radio forums. So remember, if any of these stories of interest to you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. And if you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions, or comments, just head over to the piratepartyradio.com site and submit them through the form on the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
The Right to Read by Richard Stallman. For Dan Halbert, the road to Tycho began in college, when Lisa Lenz asked to borrow his computer. Hers had broken down, and unless she could borrow another, she would fail her midterm project. There was no one she dared ask, except Dan. This put Dan in a dilemma. He had to help her, but if he lent her his computer, she might read his books. Aside from the fact that you could go to prison for many years for letting somebody else read your books, the very idea shocked him at first. Like everyone, he had been taught since elementary school that sharing books was nasty and wrong, something that only pirates would do. And there wasn't much chance that the SPA, the Software Protection Authority, would fail to catch him. In his software class, Dan had learned that each book had a copyright monitor that reported when and where it was read, and by whom, to Central Licensing. They used this information to catch reading pirates, but also to sell personal interest profiles to retailers. The next time his computer was networked, Central Licensing would find out. He, as a computer owner, would receive the harshest punishment for not taking pains to prevent the crime. Of course, Lisa did not necessarily intend to read his books. She might want the computer only to write her midterm, but Dan knew she came from a middle-class family. She could hardly afford the tuition, let alone her reading fees. Reading his books might be the only way she could graduate. He understood this situation. He himself had to borrow to pay for all the research papers he read. 10% of those fees went to the researchers who wrote the papers. Since Dan aimed for an academic career, he could hope that his own research papers, if frequently referenced, would bring in enough to repay his loan. Later on, Dan would learn there was a time when anyone could go to the library and read journal articles and even books without having to pay. There were independent scholars who read thousands of pages without government library grants. But in the 1990s, both commercial and non-profit journal publishers had begun charging fees for access. By 2047, libraries offering free public access to scholarly literature were dim memory. There were ways, of course, to get around the SPA and central licensing. They were themselves illegal. Dan had had a classmate in software, Frank Martucci, who had obtained an illicit debugging tool and used it to skip over the copyright monitor code when reading books. But he had told too many friends about it, and one of them turned him into the SPA for a reward. Students deep in debt were easily tempted into betrayal. In 2047, Frank was in prison, not for pirate reading, but for possessing a debugger. Dan would later learn that there was a time when anyone could have debugging tools. There were even free debugging tools available on CD or downloadable over the net. But ordinary users started using them to bypass copyright monitors, and eventually a judge ruled that this had become their principal use in actual practice. This meant they were illegal. The debugger's developers were sent to prison. Programmers still needed debugging tools, of course, but debugging vendors in 2047 distributed numbered copies only, and only to officially licensed and bonded programmers. The debugger Dan used in software class was kept behind a special firewall so that it could be only used for class exercises. It was also possible to bypass the copyright monitors by installing a modified system kernel. Dan would eventually find out about the free kernels, even entire free operating systems, that had existed around the turn of the century. But not only were they illegal, like debuggers, you could not install one if you had one without knowing your computer's root password. And neither the FBI nor Microsoft support would tell you that. Dan concluded that he couldn't simply lend Lisa his computer, but he couldn't refuse to help her because he loved her. Every chance to speak with her filled him with delight, and that she chose him to ask for help, that could mean she loved him too. Dan resolved the dilemma by doing something even more unthinkable. He lent her the computer and told her his password. This way, if Lisa read his books, Central Licensing would think he was reading them. It was still a crime, but the SPA would not automatically find out about it. They would only find out if Lisa reported him. Of course, if the school ever found out that he had given Lisa his own password, it would be curtains for both of them as students, regardless of what she had used it for. School policy was that any interference with their means of monitoring students' computer use was grounds for disciplinary action. It didn't matter whether you did anything harmful. The offense was making it hard for the administrators to check on you. They assumed that this meant you were doing something else forbidden, and they did not need to know what it was. Students were not usually expelled for this, not directly. Instead, they were banned from the school computer systems and would inevitably fail all their classes. Later, Dan would learn that this kind of university policy started only in the 1980s, when university students in large numbers began using computers. Previously, universities maintained a different approach to student discipline. They punished activities that were harmful, not those that merely raised suspicion. Lisa did not report Dan to the SPA. His decision to help her led to their marriage, and also led them to question what they had been taught about piracy as children. The couple began reading about the history of copyright, about the Soviet Union and its restrictions on copying, and even the original United States Constitution. They moved to Luna, where they found others who had likewise gravitated away from the long arm of the SPA. When the Tycho Uprising began in 2062, the universal right to read soon became one of its central aims.